The healthcare vote comes just as the unemployment rate hits 10.2%, a level of joblessness that the United States hasn't experienced since the early 1980s. The economy is actually growing, but as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, many employers just aren't ready to start hiring again.
October tallied another 190,000 people out of work and looking for jobs. But dig a little deeper, and economist Bernard Baumol with the Economic Outlook Group sees signs of hope. Productivity is up dramatically. In the manufacturing sector, workers are already putting in 40 hours a week. Overtime is rising.
You can only ask your existing workforce to put in so many extra hours at work, to spend so much time in the office,
before you have to break down and start hiring again to meet demand. Steve Schulte wishes he was at that point.
Take it to the next level. I'm not seeing it yet.
He owns a company called Porta King Building Systems in Earth City, Missouri. No, not porta potties. They make custom order rooms that go into factories.
It's a modular kit that we send out with all the wall systems, windows, doors, electrical components, HVAC. So it's an erector set.
Earlier this year, sales were so bad, Schulte laid off 30% of his workforce. He's brought a few people back as more orders have come in. He wishes he could hire more, but he's afraid to.
It's hand-to-mouth on a weekly basis. So if our order intake is at one level and it peaks up by 20% from one week, and then the next week it drops off 30%, that's what we're dealing with.
Schulte is worried about how health care and climate change legislation will affect his business. And then there's that sinking feeling that the economic recovery may not stick. Tom Duesterberg is president of the Manufacturers Alliance.
This recession was so severe, so broad, so long, that it's going to take us longer to come back than other recessions we've seen.
One bright spot in yesterday's jobs report was temporary employment. 34,000 temp jobs were added last month.
It shows that people have stopped laying off and are starting to hire. They're just kind of hiring at the temporary sector, not quite the full-time sector.
Jody Chavez is a senior vice president with Agilon Professional Staffing.
The temporary staff allows them to be flexible with their current workloads without making a full-time commitment, and then all the costs associated that come with that.
Like health care and retirement and unemployment insurance and workers' compensation, it's a real commitment. On Monday, Jennifer Lake starts a 3-month accounting manager job in Torrance, California.
I am thrilled beyond belief that I am going to have a paycheck coming. As a single parent, I'm on my own, so it's just a terrifying proposition to not be working.
Still, Lake has mixed feelings and says the idea that she could be out of work again soon is unsettling. But her temp job and the thousands of others that were filled last month could signal permanent jobs are on the way. In past recessions, employers hired temps first, and then a few months later started making permanent hires. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. House of Representatives finally opens debate today on its health care overhaul bill. President Obama is making the trip up to Pennsylvania Avenue to lobby lawmakers in person in advance of the vote, which could be close. NPR's Julie Rovner joins us. She's been covering the health care debate all year. Julie, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Remind us, this version that may draw a vote, what's in it?
Well, there are three main goals to the bill. It is to help provide coverage to people who don't have it, to shore up coverage for people who do, all the while slowing the rise of health costs. The bill would require everyone to have insurance, most employers to help pay for it, and the government to provide subsidies to poor and middle-class people. Now, the Congressional Budget Office says the bill would cover about 36 million more people. Mm-hmm. That's about 96% of the population that's here legally, since illegal immigrants won't be eligible for benefits. For people people who have insurance, it would end the practice of denials based on pre-existing conditions, things like charging women more because they tend to use more health care, and imposing annual and lifetime benefits limits. Those are things that today often lead people to be what we call underinsured. On the cost side, the bill would pay for itself, says the CBO, largely through reductions in Medicare spending and a new tax on high-income earners, people generally earning over about $500,000. But it wouldn't do as much as many health economists had hoped to really change health care incentives, do what they call bend the health care cost curve.
And we keep hearing that the Democrats need to drum up votes from within their own caucus. Does this mean a hope of bipartisan support for this or any bill is gone?
Well, certainly this bill, there's not much hope of bipartisan support. It went through three different committees on its way to the floor, not a single Republican vote. That means of the 258 Democrats in the House right now, including the two new members elected this week, the leaders have to find 218 to get the bill through. It is proving surprisingly difficult.
Why?
Well, they've got pretty much two issues that have been dogging them for months now, abortion and immigration. On abortion, the goal was to write a bill that was policy neutral, that basically didn't change the status quo, which is that federal funds shouldn't be used to pay for abortion, but that most private plans do offer abortion as a benefit. The problem is that with these subsidies that are going to be going to private plans, you have now the specter of offering federal funds to pay for private plans. So there's still this fight about how to craft that language. On immigration, there's widespread agreement that no benefits should go to people who are here illegally. But in the House bill, there is a provision that says people here illegally could use their own money to buy coverage in these new marketplaces called exchanges. That's not in the Senate bill. President Obama has expressed a preference for the Senate bill. That has angered about 20 members of the House Hispanic Caucus who are threatening not to vote for the bill if that language is taken out.
This bill in the House of Representatives got a couple of high-profile endorsements late in the week, right?
Yes, indeed it did. The AARP and the American Medical Association endorsed the Democrats' bill. Here's AARP Executive Vice President Nancy LeMond.
We've read the House of Representatives' Affordable Health Care for America Act, and we can say with confidence that it meets our priorities for protecting Medicare, providing more affordable insurance for 50 to 64-year-olds, and reforming our health care system.
Here's the American Medical Association President, James Rohack.
Now, H.R. 3962 is not a perfect representation of the AMA's view, but it's consistent with enough of our goals to warrant support to keep the process moving.
This day and age, there are a lot of political analysts that question the value and utility of endorsements.
Yeah, there are. And, you know, both of these endorsements were expected, the AMA in particular, because doctors are looking at a 20% cut in pay under Medicare unless Congress does something to fix it by January. So they're pretty much over a barrel. They pretty much had to endorse this bill. But, you know, it's certainly better to have groups backing your bill than not. And certainly the public is very confused about this issue, and they tend to look to groups that they trust. And these are, for better or worse, groups that much of the public trust. So, indeed, these were considered big endorsements in terms of this bill, and certainly groups that the Democrats courted very strongly.
What's the status of this or any legislation in the Senate?
Well, the Senate's in a bit of a holding pattern. They are waiting for the Congressional Budget Office, who's been working on the House bill, to give them estimates of the bill that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's trying to put together. They're hoping to perhaps start a debate by the end of the month. That could be on the Senate floor probably until Christmas.
And happy holidays, Julie.
Thanks, Scott.
And NPR's Julie Rovner. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, the largest mass shooting ever at a military base in the United States. Unemployment climbs into the double digits, and the runoff election in Afghanistan is called off. NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore joins us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
And obviously, the biggest story of the week as we sit here is the tragic shooting at Fort Hood, Texas on Thursday.
Yes. And what's there to say about it? You know, it is our job here to interpret, to draw generalizations, to compare it to how about Columbine, how about Virginia Tech and other massacres. And I can't add it up. I'm looking at my country and saying, I don't understand it. What do we know about this young man, this major? Other than that, he's Muslim. you can find all these little tidbits of information about him, lead you still gasping for what is this all about.
Do people look for overall significance when they're to try and connect a crime like this to overall social patterns or political policies when there may be no link at all?
Well, people need something to explain it to themselves. You can't go home and sit there with your family and say, why? You look for explanations. The result of that is that, as you suggest, occasionally you go off on very little information and you speculate about it. I have resolutely decided that on this one, I understand so little about what is fundamentally behind it that the one thing I will avoid is quick speculation.
Okay. Let's get to the economy, which unemployment rate passed over 10% on Friday. First time we've had double-digit employment since 1983. Now, this figure reflects that hundreds of thousands of people in this country are looking for work.
That's right.
What are some of the other implications?
Well, there are all kinds of implications, one of which obviously is political. I mean, we've just been through an election where there may already have been some influence on the votes of the economic situation, and now we're looking ahead a year to the to next year's election, and yes, there can be profound political fallout from all of this.
And in elections around the country this week, of course, Republicans won a couple of governorships in New Jersey and Virginia.
Yes.
What do you see as the political implications of this election system?
I think that's not very hard to figure out.
The double-digit unemployment.
Not terribly good for the Democrats. I mean, the Republicans may be on their way to a comeback after they fared so badly in last year's election. We don't know yet for sure. There may be other changes. But at the moment, you win two important governorships. And even though the Republicans did not succeed in winning the House seat in upstate New York, Democrats will tell you it's not good news.
Will the election results, and maybe more to the point, the polling information and the focus groups that attend an event like that have any influence over the vote on health care legislation in Congress, which might occur this weekend?
That's an interesting question. We apparently are headed for the first vote in the House of Representatives in the next several days. And what effect will that have? Well, everything in the end becomes a referendum on the Obama presidency. We know already that his polls indicate that his policies, if not himself, are no longer terribly popular. Mm-hmm. And he has to really win one. And now this becomes a key thing. He's chosen to make his first real test, his health care plan. He's putting everything he has into it. I mean, there are a lot of nails being bitten. It has not only to do with health, but it has to do with the political health of this country. And everybody waits and to see. Speaker Pelosi says she thinks she's going to win in the House. Well, maybe. We wait with great tension to see.
As you and I chatted last week, we expected a runoff election in Afghanistan. It was canceled this week when President Karzai's challenger, Abdullah, declined to participate, said he was concerned that the election might not be honest, fraud might reappear. What's the reaction to his decision been?
Well, the reaction to this decision is to raise again the question of where the United States stands now. Will the United States send the extra troops, which they've been talking about low for these many, many weeks and apparently are having trouble making up their minds? And it is a question. This government now is so shaky that to say we back this government raises questions in itself. In the end, there is no way out for this administration other than supporting Karzai, who is the only one they have. If they don't support him, then they really give up on Afghanistan, which they're not quite ready to do yet.
20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yes.
You are the only man I've ever heard of who covered the wall when it went up and you covered it when it came down. What are your reflections now?
Isn't that something? I think it was one of the great events in post-war history because look at that in retrospect. The wall coming down marked the beginning of the end of the whole Soviet Empire. Everything else then followed Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. And to see, look today and see that East Germany, what was called East Germany, produced the person who is now the chancellor of all of Germany, namely Angela Merkel, I would not have predicted that.
Dan Shore, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Chef Evan Kleiman has a lot on her plate. That successful Los Angeles restaurant she runs, Angeli Cafe, an award-winning public radio program, a series of cookbooks, and now a whole lot of pie, more than 100 pies and counting, first on her blog, and now a contest that has Southern California rolling in dough. She joins us now from member station KCRW in Santa Monica. Evan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So what's the thing about you and pie?
Well, first of all, I love pie. And pie has sort of receded in the last few years. You know, I couldn't remember the last time I'd really made a beautiful double crust pie. So I thought at the beginning of the summer, why don't I make a pie a day? And so I figured the only way we'd actually do it was if I made a public announcement via the Good Food blog at KCRW, where my radio show is. And the next thing I know, it just blossomed into this sort of hidden community of pie hogs.
So what are some of the interesting things that you've come across?
During this quest?
Yeah, exactly. What recipe has come in on the blog or through the contest that just has made you go, gee, I never thought about that?
I guess for me, the most interesting part of this journey is how much there is to learn and how fiddly the little differences are. My best success happened with Alton Brown, the man behind the show Good Eats, who's known so much for his food science that he shares with everybody, but also just the way he fiddles with recipes until he gets it exactly how he wants it. And I learned, first of all, to use a sprayer to add my water to the dough instead of just drizzling it in, because if you add too much liquid to a pie dough, you'll get a lot of toughness, and you don't want that. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing he does was substitute fruit juice for part of the water. So, for example, if I'm making an apple pie, I will use apple juice concentrate, and it just lifts the flavor.
Now, how's this contest work?
Several weeks ago, we put up a form on our website, and any listener could decide what pie they wanted to enter and told us what they're going to bring. And we have 142 pies. Hopefully, we're going to have a lot of eaters as well as contestants.
So what makes a good pie?
You know, that is such a personal thing. For me, it's all about excellent, beautiful farmers market fruit that has a ton of flavor, tucked into the perfect crust that has enough of the flakiness to just really want me to fork in mouthful after mouthful.
You haven't been eating so much pie that it's, let me put this nicely, it's altered your appearance notably.
Well, I have to say that I'm not a lightweight, let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid
You're clearly a very thoughtful person.
I was afraid of what this pie would do to my appearance. But in fact, it turns out that if you have a slice of pie for breakfast, that you are good for the day and you're so satisfied that you don't feel you need to be bad. I mean, I don't like using that word, but you know what I mean.
You making anything special, a special pie for Thanksgiving? I mean, if you just say pumpkin.
No. Well, I'm going to do the Alton Brown double-crusted apple pie, which I just love so much. But I'm also doing an espresso chocolate pecan pie.
Oh, mercy. Well, I like that espresso part.
It just has a tiny bit of chunks of Belgian chocolate in it.
Oh, my word. A tiny chunk of Belgian chocolate could sink the Titanic. Well, good luck to you. Good eating.
Thank you so much.
Evan Kleiman, host of Good Food on member station KCRW in Santa Monica. And you can find out more about the pie contest on our blog, npr.org/soapbox.
Despite what the Yankees achieved this past week, the World Series is not over. But I'm talking about a different group of nine men and a different sort of diamond. The World Series of Poker kicked off its final table this afternoon, and sitting at that table, nine players whittled down from a field of almost 6,500. In a few minutes, we'll meet the man who went into the day as the chip leader, Darvin Moon. He's a logger who cut his poker teeth in small stakes games in the mountains of western Maryland. First, though, a little background on the game itself. Writer James McManus believes that poker explains a lot about who we are as a culture. His new book is a history of the game with all its unsavory and distinguished practitioners. It's called Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. And James McManus is in the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Guy.
You write that the game is interwoven into the American DNA. What do you mean by that?
The entrepreneurial spirit of a fledgling democracy made it fairly natural that poker would become the game. Its language is money, its means of keeping score, and it's open to all classes of society.
But early on, the game was associated with cheats and sort of Wild West shootouts, right?
What we would call poker skill today, had very little to do with who took the long money home in high-stakes game in the 19th century. The artistry of poker had more to do with being able to deal seconds or passing the cards over a mirrored ring on the inside of your hands, or as we saw in the movie The Sting, when Robert Shaw has a cold deck prepared for Paul Newman,
right.
And Paul Newman's cronies managed to get into the game a double cold deck so that Robert Shaw thinks he's going to win with four nines. He actually loses all his money when Paul Newman famously says, four jacks, you owe me 15 grand, pal.
And a great film. You spoke with us actually last year on this program about President Barack Obama and his love of poker. And he's just sort of the latest in a long line of commanders-in-chief who've mm-hmm. been drawn to the game.
President Obama falls very clearly into there's a number of stripes of presidential poker players. Most of them are like Obama, FDR, Truman, Teddy Roosevelt. They played as a way to relax with their cronies, to widen their political circle. The two players who were the most effective high-stakes players in their lifetimes were Eisenhower and Nixon. Hmm. Eisenhower successfully courts Mamie Dowd, a wealthy Denver socialite, with poker winnings. Nixon wins $8,000 in the mid-40s, enough to finance his first successful congressional campaign.
Now, you actually teach a class on poker, on its history mm-hmm. and strategy at the mm-hmm. School of the Art.
And the literature as well.
And literature at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And you mm-hmm. point out that poker strategy is now widely taught at business schools?
Mm-hmm. David Sklansky, one of the premier philosophers and primer writers, his books are assigned to traders at Susquehanna Partners and a number of other financial services industries. Poker logic is about leveraging uncertainty and managing risk as effectively as possible, using psychology, logic, and mathematics in order to make effective bets about what's going to happen either at the table or in the marketplace.
You conclude in your book that poker has actually made this country a stronger one, not a more sinful one. What do you think the Puritans would have made of that?
The Puritan instinct is alive today. And it tends to not appreciate poker skill, winning money by cunning and aggression. However, what's made America great is the combination of Puritan work ethic and the entrepreneurial cowboy's desire to get rich quick by taking big risks. It's the combination of those two things, as parents' genes combine in their children, that has made America what it is today.
James McManus is the author of Cowboys Full, The Story of Poker. He joined us from KUOW in Seattle. James McManus, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Guy.
By the way, you made it to the final table at the World Series of Poker back in 2000. What do you think of this Darvin Moon fellow? Do you think he has a shot?
Well, if I proved anything in 2000, it's that if you play reasonably well and get very lucky, nobody wins a poker tournament without playing very, very well and getting extremely lucky. And Darvin Moon, he would be the person that I would bet on. And I wish Darvin luck.
Thank you. I'm going to need all the luck I can get.
That is Darvin Moon, and he's about as far as you can get from poker royalty. Joining me now here in the studio for a look at the headlines of the past week is our news analyst, James Fallows from The Atlantic. Jim, good to see you.
Thank you, Guy.
Let's start with Fort Hood. What makes this different from other mass shootings we've had in the country?
You know, every one of these things that comes up, there is something distinctive about. There was the Amish country shooting 2 years ago in Columbine, back in a long history through Charles Whitman at the University of Texas. And this one, of course, the objective circumstances were on their face more alarming. It was on an Army base. The victims were soldiers going off to combat. It was a medical doctor and an Army officer who was doing the shooting, and not simply somebody of an Arabic name, but a practicing Muslim who apparently was calling out Al-Akbar as he shot, according to some reports. And so if this were, and the worst possibility, of course, would be that this was an indication of some sort of terrorist activity or sleeper cell, one would have expected, if that were so, there would have been reverberations around the world and claims of credit and all the rest. It seems, based on what is known so far, that this is yet again in the toll of these tragic events where people go crazy and we never really know why.
Just another madman, basically.
Yes. I mean, it sounds harsh to put it that way, given the casualties and the families, you know, that have been just torn apart by this. But that is what has been the case in most of these over the years.
Jim, on to health care for a moment. The House looks closer than ever now to passing a bill, but passing it along fiercely partisan lines.
You and I have both been listening to these speeches through the day on the House floor via C-SPAN and the other coverage, and even in the long history of House floor rhetoric, this is pretty extreme. On the one hand, you have people saying the Constitution is at risk and all the rest, and the proponent is saying this, we need this as a real step towards reform in America. What strikes me is the contrast between this and President Obama's campaign rhetoric about red America and blue America becoming one America. Probably this will go through with no votes from the Republicans in the House. And the best thing you can say is that when the two parties run next year in the midterm elections, at least the divisions will be clear. Their party alignment is pretty obvious on this one.
Jim, this week we learned that the unemployment rate is now the highest since 1982, I believe, but the underemployment figures may be the highest in modern U.S. history.
You know, we have heard over the last year that this is the worst economic episode since the Great Depression.
Right.
This is the first really objective proof of that, where the number of people who are both officially unemployed and discouraged workers and involuntary part-time workers, people would like to be working full-time and cannot, comes by the latest reckoning to 17.5%, which is the highest on record, higher than the previous time under the early Reagan years. And that is a sign of the toll this is having on the United States. Also, I think the really sort of challenging aspect here is that even before the financial collapse of a year ago, the sort of polarization economically of the U.S. and other countries was the big problem. And that obviously is the factor here. One other sort of reverse whammy twist here. Compared with even the 2001 or 1980 recessions, fewer people relatively have actually been laid off this time than before. The real toll has been people who are not getting hired. And again, which is suggesting this kind of polarization. You have the job or you don't, and the gap is sort of increasing.
And on your blog this past week, you had a posting that suggested this could last well into 2011.
That certainly is the case, that in even the most benign of recessions, the last thing to improve is the employment rate, because employers naturally wait to see that the business has come back and the risks have gone down. They think, okay, now we can expand the workforce. So even in the best circumstances, it would take a while, and it's possible this rate, already very high, could go up further.
Jim, tomorrow on this program, we will be marking the 20th anniversary, a day before, rather, of the fall of the Berlin Wall, happened on November 9th, 1989. Since then, of course, America's foreign policy focus has been totally different.
It certainly has. And while, of course, the change in the former Eastern Bloc is the greatest of any in the world over the last 20 years, I'm struck that what people said 20 years ago about the effect on the U.S. is, if anything, understated. That for the previous four decades, our foreign policy had been aligned mainly around containing the Soviet Union. Everything domestically and militarily and rhetorically and all the rest had that as organizing principle. With the absence of the Soviet Union, number one, we have all this kind of random threat coming around the world, whether it's nuclear proliferation or terrorism or failed states or all the rest. And since that time, economic challenges have loomed larger and larger. The fall of the Soviet Union was the last time we had a weaker economic challenge to worry about. That now we had Japan 20 years ago, China, India, and the rest now.
That's our news analyst, James Fallows. Jim, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.